Welcome to Survive and Thrive, DW Academy's dialogue with media managers on innovative and sustainable business models in a challenging global media landscape. We'll talk motivation, lessons learned, funding models, decisions both good and bad, and recipes for success.
Hello again, and welcome to Survive and Thrive, your media viability podcast. Today, we're talking about the everyday challenges and the surprising opportunities involved in doing just that. Having the media outlet you run not just survive, but thrive. I'm Janelle Dumalaon. Every media outlet is different, but indeed, there are many overlaps. The daily decision-making, both editorial and operational. Sustainable financing. Making sure you're speaking to the audience you want to speak to, while maintaining broad appeal. Our next guest knows what it's like to address the world and future-facing ways of storytelling from a city with a deep and complex history. I'd like to welcome Zenzele Nedebele, founder and director of the news nonprofit CITE, that stands for the Center for Innovation and Technology. Welcome, Zenzele.
Thank you.
Now, in a moment, we'll go deep into what it means to run an organization like CITE from where you're running it from, that is to say, Bulawayo, Zimbabwe. But first, we have a short round of introductory questions for you. Again, looking for quick answers, let's keep it rolling. Your business model in a catchphrase.
Innovate.
That really is a catchphrase. Innovate. Did you ever manage a moment when everything seemed lost?
Endure.
What would you need to thrive in the future?
Sustainability.
All right. So innovate, endurance, sustainability. First question for you. You started CITE in 2017. What did it start as and what is it today?
I'd say maybe briefly, my background comes from a person who has always looked for alternatives. So my history in the media starts around 2000 when there were no any other alternatives in Zimbabwe. There were no community radios, no commercial radios, just state-owned radio stations. So back then we used to produce cassettes, produce programs, package them on cassette, cassettes, those old cassettes, and then distribute them in public commuters and people listen to that. And they'll think that it is a real program and they'll phone. Unfortunately, there was a landline and they'll then realize that it's not live. So I developed the interest from there. And with the advent of social media, so we then started CITE, and it started off as a, you know, an organization that was young people. Each time there was an event in the community, they would go and tweet about it, Facebook about it, do live shows, you know, Facebook Live using mobile phones on what was going on. And it has developed into a fully fledged media organization that is registered as a mass media organization, employing over 24 people working every day.
So just want to point out here, your story begins with cassettes and you find yourself now working with AI newsreaders. We'll have more on the AI in just a minute, but just to showcase what a journey you've already been through, how would you describe CITE's mission?
Well, our mission is to, in simple terms, to tell the story of the ordinary people. You know, there are so many things that are not being told, and we want to be that voice that talks about the stories of marginalized people. We come from a marginalized community, and we want to, you know, I always say in my bio, you know, until the lion knows how to read and write, you never know about the victories of the lion. Because the man is always going to write fake news about their own victories. So we are the lion that is telling the victories of other lions.
Now, who would be man in this case? Like, who are you trying to triumph over, so to say?
We come from the minority, so we'll be trying to triumph one over the majority who I live in Zimbabwe, want to triumph over the political forces or the elite We have always wanted ordinary people not to tell the story, because every newspaper that you read, every main news bulletin that you see, it's about the powerful. It's about the politician who has attended a G7 summit, who has attended the, visiting this, visiting that. But the ordinary person in the street has, who has challenges, be it water, be it electricity, be it, basic things like health, their stories are not told. And those are the stories that we want to amplify. Those are the people that we want to always be in our headlines. You know, as someone who is coming from an African country, there is always this history that we went to the liberation struggle. Our parents fought so that we have a better life. And sometimes I believe that the people who fought for their freedom never knew how freedom looked like and never knew how freedom would be. And now, 43 years after independence, we still have the challenges that we used to have during the colonial era. And I find myself asking, but why did my parents go to war? Why did they fight for? Because we still have the oppression. We still have, the lack of, respect for human rights. We still live in the same squalor conditions. We're still fighting for land. So why did my parents fight for? And those are the stories that I want to tell every day when I wake up, that somewhere, lies freedom, and my people should test freedom in my lifetime.
I can imagine for many reasons that is an outsized challenge. But what would be one kind of a story that you would say is representative of the reporting that you do at site?
We do a lot of a number of community stories, especially on service delivery. We are there to also, as the fourth estate, as the media, to hold authorities to account. So we always ask questions about how that deal that you signed, how many dollars was it supposed to cost? Did you get the true value of the money? What happened to that tender? You promised during elections that you're going to give communities piped water. Where is the piped water?
Now, I'm reminded of that old adage, hearing you speak today about how the mission, of course, is to, what was it? Was it to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable? And I guess that sounds very much like what you're trying to do. So at the top of the show, Zanzila, we talked about Bulawayo as a special place from which to do reporting. What can you tell us about what it's like being of this community, but also reporting for this community?
I mean, the people of Bulawayo have a sense of pride. They pride themselves, of course, of their history and many other things. But there are people who have endured a lot. Immediately after independence, there was a genocide in Zimbabwe, better known by many people as Gukurahundi, where over 20,000 Matebele people were killed, unfortunately killed by the Zimbabwean army. They were killed basically because they belonged to a different tribe and they did not support the party that was in government then, which is still the party that is in government now. And that is a story that has not been told. And a lot of people still wonder what happened to their families. They still wonder why their parents were killed or their relatives were killed. And it's something that keeps turning up in every major conversation that we have. I can assure you that if you were to walk in Bulawayo today in a town hall and have a meeting, you will not go out without someone raising the issue of the Gukurahundi genocide, because people still long for, they want an apology from government, they want justice, they still have, they need answers. And the government has not been forthright and they've not been forthcoming about these issues, and they've always been, actually making it so difficult for people to talk about this. Until recently, it was more like a crime to talk about Gukurahundi. You'd be arrested, you'd be intimidated and all sorts of things. So it's my province, or my area where I come from, it's a lot of people who are very hopeful that the future holds something better, but very angry and bitter about the past. And these are people who have a past that has not been solved, and they hold grudges. They need a space to vent, to talk about what happened and ask questions why it happened.
You talk about the service element of the work you do, and it sounds like that is a very big part of it. How does that history shape the reporting that you do today?
I think in a big way it does, because every story that we cover, it has to answer the question, and so what? So what does it mean for Matabele land? And the fact that we still have talk about transitional justice, we still have to talk about undocumented citizens who don't have birth certificates. And because they don't have birth certificates and they don't have identity documents, they are missing a lot of opportunities, be it jobs, be it education. So you find that one way or the other in our stories, we are influenced by the community that we live in. I mean, there is no need for us to talk about Hollywood when we are not in Hollywood. There's no need for us to talk about, heaven when we're in hell. So if you are in hell, we'll talk about hell. And if we're in heaven, we are going to talk about heaven. So mainly our agenda is influenced by the stories of the community, a better life, a fight for a better life, but also a fight for justice and a fight for, making authorities account.
Now, earlier in our conversation, you were talking about the media landscape and how there was a dearth of independent media. There was mostly state-owned radio stations at the time you started operating. Now you talked about the importance of making sure that the content that you deliver is relevant for your community. You just said there's no reason to talk about heaven if, in fact, you find yourselves in hell. But That could be the lead-in to my next question here, which is describe a bit of the landscape that site is operating in. Hopefully it is not completely hellish.
I think over the last few years, the media environment has improved. There was a time when being a journalist was like, a crime. A police officer will see you carrying a camera and they will arrest you for just carrying a camera. There were also always all sorts of, number of times when we had to go to a police station to answer questions why I was filming and all the kind of things. But over the time, I think there have been a lot of efforts that have been done by media houses. Where now, there have been a lot of training between police and journalists for police officers and authorities to understand that probably in the work that we do, we are also trying to help them. It is not the best place to be. You are likely to face challenges still. There's a lot of political interference or, political intolerance in the work that we do. There are still a lot of threats. There are stories that you do and you know that after that story, you're not going to go and sleep at home. Maybe now we can say there's freedom of speech, but no freedom after speech. Although the Constitution guarantees the freedom of the press, we still find out that there's a lot of political pressure. Journalists get threatened for raising and asking very relevant questions. You get trolled a lot on social media. I myself have received two or three death threats on social media, Twitter, because of the work that I do and the things that I've said. But it's journalism in Zimbabwe is a contact sport. So you really have to develop a thick skin to be able to do the work that we do, because not everyone who want. I think people are used to follow the minister kind of journalism, where it's always the president said, the president have said. When we then say the president did not, it becomes an issue.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that there have been improvements to the environment, but there is still a certain atmosphere of intimidation. There are definite risks to the job. Now, apart from developing a thick skin, as you called it, you, of course, are a part of a team of around 24 journalists, if I read that correctly. Do you have strategies for how to keep each other safe?
It's a difficult thing to do. At the end of the day, we need to survive. There's no story that is worth dying for. But when it's the nature of the job, when you practice journalism in Zimbabwe, carry a jersey in your car, because you might wake up in the police station. So while we have worked with a number of organizations, legal associations, advocates, organizations to try and make an environment better, honestly, I can't guarantee that a journalist would come to work in the morning and go home without facing any problems, because something might turn up. They might be arrested for a story that they've done. The problem that we are talking about the environment having improved, but there are laws that have not been changed. We still have funny laws like, undermining the authority of the president. If you say my president is ugly, you can be arrested for undermining the authority of the president. There are some, I was once arrested and the charge was being a nuisance. you know, yeah, being a nuisance. And if you try to say, what is being a nuisance? It means anything and everything. You know, a police officer can arrest you for looking at him and he suspects that you want to commit a crime. So we still have very silly laws in our statutes that have not been, you know, aligned. We still have, you know, although the issue of criminal defamation has been struck off the laws, but then we still have people being arrested for criminal defamation. And I find that of late, there have been a number of laws that are being proposed to try and bring those laws that have been struck off. So I won't be surprised the next few months when we do have, you know, criminal defamation. We have, you know, what we call popularly as the Patriotic Act, you know, where you can be arrested for not being patriotic, for talking bad about your country, for espionage, you know, selling to foreign powers, and all sorts of those things that you don't find in democratic societies. And now we also have, you know, the talk about cyber laws that really also try and you know, bring back some of the things that were declared unconstitutional. So it is those things that we are at the back of our minds to say, yeah, the environment might be having improved, but a police officer can still find something to charge you with. If you can't find anything, you can, in fact, the offense that I talk about is called criminal nuisance. You know, you can still be arrested for criminal nuisance.
And I guess the question really is there, you know, what can you do if the application of these laws, if the laws themselves are quite spurious and their application even more so? Now, you talked about cyber laws. You're present on every platform imaginable, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. That's not, of course, uncommon for the news organizations of today. But given that, of course, the internet is a much harder to regulate space, is the diversity of your formats on all sorts of on all sorts of platforms, is that an advantage in this restrictive landscape, or is it a liability?
I think it is an advantage because we are talking to different audiences in these platforms. You know, we are on TikTok and it's mainly young people, you know, the 8, 11, 12, or, you know, the younger audience, 8 to the ages of 35 or so, but you still have older people on TikTok, although watching the content. We are on Twitter, which is mainly mature, you know, people who pretend to be intellectuals. They'll debate and they'll do on this thing. Facebook is the public bar of some sort where you find every riffraff on Facebook talking about social issues. Then yeah, so it's different platforms, different content. So we package differently our videos and our content for all these different platforms because there are different people that are there. You can engage in a very constructive discussion on Twitter. And every day in the morning, we have a Twitter space where we discuss, you know, current affairs issues. But I find it so much different with Facebook. You can engage in a social topic on Facebook, and with TikTok, it's a different format altogether, a different audience altogether. So I think there is an advantage in having all these different platforms that we use because we do then talk to different audiences.
Maybe you can talk a little bit more about the formats that you have. So I see, for example, that you have a promise tracker, you have a fact-checking format, you have a sort of breakfast show. So what are these sort of different formats and how do they feed into each other?
So the Breakfast Show, the Breakfast Lab, is a daily show, current affairs show that I present every day. We put that on Facebook and on YouTube. It's a longer format. The program is 30 minutes and we normally talk about issues that are happening. It's a current affairs program. So we talk about politics, you know, economics, but what's going on, what has happened and what does it mean to our people. But once we have done that 30 minutes on Facebook and uploaded the 30 minutes on YouTube, we then cut smaller clips. You know, like 30-minute sound bites, 1-minute sound bites. Those are the sound bites that we post on Twitter for conversations. But we also post those shorter clips on WhatsApp. We are also we have big WhatsApp groups. I think our WhatsApp subscription is around 13 to 15,000 people who are on WhatsApp. These are the people who might not have enough data to go on Twitter or to watch shows on YouTube. So we would tell them what they need to know in smaller, doses on WhatsApp clips that are less than 10 megabytes. If you make your clip much larger, 15 or so megabytes, they'll start complaining that you're finishing their data. So, you know, data is also another issue. So it has to be smaller, and then they will, you know, enjoy the show, the bits and pieces. We also do like what we call we have the promise tracker. The idea of the promise tracker is to say in Zimbabwe and mostly in Africa and everywhere in the world, each time politicians are contesting for power, they make a lot of promises. We are going to do this, we're going to build schools, we're going to build clinics, we're going to do A, B, C, D. And most of the times, once they're in power, they abandon whatever they talked about and do the other thing. So the idea of the promise tracker is to track promises that have been made, policies that have been made by those who are in power to see if they really follow up on those promises. And of course, being in the digital world where we are so much into use of AI algorithms that then create filter bubbles and troll factories and so forth. So we have a big issue of fake news. You know, someone just sees something on WhatsApp or online which is not true, then they forward. So this way, especially when we have elections, you have a lot of fake news and misinformation that is going on. So we then now have a fact-checking desk that every information that we see circulating, and we also ask people. Sometimes people call us and say, I saw this thing circulating. Is it true? Then we have to fact-check. So we have guys who are fact-checking stories, and we do the rumor tracking. You know, what are the rumors that are circulating, and those rumors, which rumors are true? You know, we have a situation whereby everyone is jumping into WhatsApp, and we have sometimes very old people in their 60s and 70s who are on WhatsApp, and they really don't understand what is going on. And with the coming in of AI and a lot of deep fakes going, when you see your parents circulating something that is not very true. So you now have to take the job of educating them why it's not true. For them, they've seen a person talking, so therefore it has happened.
You've touched a bit about the dark side of AI in the media landscape, of course, that it makes the proliferation of fake news so much easier. But You're also trying to use it for good, so to say. And you have like one particular experiment that's gaining some traction. You have AI news readers. So how is that going? What have the challenges been like? And what are you learning as you conduct these sort of storytelling experiments with AI?
Yeah, we started off last year when we decided to experiment around AI, because it is a growing trend. News organizations are cutting their costs by using AI, but also it's effective. You know, we produced a lot of content during elections. We usually would do a bulletin with a team of seven people. Now it can be done by one person. You know, if it takes the whole day to do a news bulletin using human beings, you can take 30 minutes to do a news bulletin with AI. So then we have also then gone on to do other programs, weather report, co-present with the AI presenters. It is a mixed bag. You know, there are some people who are actually, today we're posting on Twitter that we have introduced a new AI presenter. So we wanted the public to participate and choose a name for this AI presenter that we have introduced. And you get comments like, so you now want to, take jobs from human beings and give them to AI. I believe that we are still far off from a situation where AI will take over the newsrooms, because AI will not go out and interview people, but AI can complement the work of the journalists and let journalists do the more serious stuff like investigative reporting, like following up on the projects in the communities and what politicians say. And AI will do the reading and the writing of stories by press statements. So we have done a research as well to find out what people think about AI. It's a mixed feeling. Young people think that it's innovative, it's the new thing, it's the in thing. Older people think that AI does not have the emotion, it doesn't represent the real person, you know, it lacks something. But we have, you know, the interesting part with our AI presenter, Alice. I mean, we have seen a lot of guys asking Alice for coffee and all the things. When can I take you for lunch? No matter how many times we say, hi, this is Alice, an AI presenter, some guy will always hit on Alice. And so I read all the emails and I get nice pickup lines on the Alice inbox.
I mean, do you take that as a sort of sign that she's making a personal impact on these people?
It means she's looking as real as a person. Because no matter how many times she says, "Hi, my name is Alice, an AI presenter." My own sister, she's of course she's I think she's in her 60s. She said to me, "How come your presenter never changes her clothes? She's always wearing the same clothes every day." So I had to say, this is a person who's not a person. And sometimes with the easier part, some people don't understand what we mean. Then we then say, "Alice is a robot." And people say, "Ah, a robot that looks like a person." So it's still, because it looks so real, and sometimes it's scary as well. So we have started a process of cloning our own presenters and making them AI presenters in case they're not there or they need to work remotely. For me, it's fascinating, it's fun. That's where the future is going. But yeah, there are a lot of challenges that we need to, the AI biases, the copyright issues, those are the things that we need to be aware of. The accuracy, the news, I mean, hearing the stories. I have a friend of mine who was in charge of introducing computers in a newsroom in the early 90s where the guys were using typewriters. And the guys were resistant to computers, and they said, "No, this thing of yours makes our work disappear," because they were used to typewriting, and they will use a computer and not save, and they will forget the work will disappear. And they were resistant. Even if you go to the Industrial Revolution, we know of serious men who died because they wanted to compete with the drills. And we know of stories where workers went into factories and broke down the new machines, the weave machines in the 1920s, in the great tide of Industrial Revolution. So people are always going to be resistant to change, and they are resistant to new technology. But I think the reason why we don't have dinosaurs now is because they could not adapt to change. And in the journalism industry, if we want to behave like dinosaurs, we are going to be extinct.
You talked quite a bit about the reception that AI, your Alice, your AI newsreader has gotten. You ask 100 people what they think about AI, you'll get 100 different responses. Something it's a cool new wave to ride on into the future. Others think that you're taking jobs away from real human beings. As you pointed out, some see an opportunity in Alice for a date. But one question that we definitely have here is, what does that then mean for trust in journalism if they can't sort of agree on Alice as a credible source for news?
I think there's people trust brands, and I think they do trust site as an organization. And with time, they get used to Alice. And there's always going to be mixed reaction as we introduce this, like anything new that comes. But we have never really come across someone who says your story was not true. But the other thing that we need to mention is currently we're using Western technology. So in terms of the language models, they're Western. We have not yet developed African models. So in terms of pronunciation, Alice struggles with local languages. The way she pronounces local languages sounds Western. And some people are not comfortable with that. They'll say, "But why doesn't your presenter, present a local language, nicely? Why are they mispronouncing our names? Where are they from? Are they from the other tribe?" And then you get these tribal issues. So, and with time, then you have to explain. So we are starting somewhere. I believe that we are here where we are today because we've always been first on the scene with this. Well, I can safely say we are one of the first media organizations in Africa to introduce AI news readers, and some are learning from us. It is a sustainability option for us because we are now working with other media organizations in Africa, training them in the use of AI, and that's a source of income for us.
I mean, one can also imagine that sort of these challenges around regionalization and making sure that Alice sounds genuinely like she is from somewhere in Zimbabwe, and she said her accent sounds more credible. I think that's just a matter of time. It's like it will get there at some point. But where do you then plan to take AI in your organization? What other applications do you see?
We have started writing soft news using AI, issues like, you know, press statements, researches. If we get a research that has been published or a report, we can use AI. I believe AI can report on soccer. I'm not big on soccer, but it's always the same. The person can pass, can miss, can head the ball. What else can they do? So the vocabulary when it comes to soccer, it can be limited to 14 or 15 words. You know, so AI can, I then just replace names week in and week out. I believe AI can report soccer better than human beings. I believe that AI can simplify financial reporting. A lot of the financial statements that are published by public media, the ordinary person doesn't understand what they're talking about because it's just numbers. But if you can use AI to draw graphs, to draw pie charts, to make it simple and understandable, so AI can do good work in financial reporting. AI will not do a good job in investigating, so we are not yet there. So I believe that as we go on, I mean, it's effective. Things will be done in a short period of time, and we will slowly build on the use of AI wherever possible. It's innovation. It's trying to find new ways of telling stories in a more interesting thing. So aside, we're really increasing our funding and our budgets around the use of AI. And in the next 3 to 5 years, I think 50% of our newsroom will be automated.
And how does your newsroom feel about that?
Honestly, initially there was resistance. I think there's still a bit of resistance. We have freelancers who are paid per story. And some of our guys are paid per story. So the moment we say, guys, now every press statement that comes in is going to be written by AI. Every report that is sent by any organization is going to be written by AI. We are taking a bit of job from an easy job, easy money from a reporter. So we are asking our reporters to then go out and find more challenging stories that AI will not go out. So they will, you know, find a bit of resistance Yeah, I think they don't like Alice, but Alice is a stepchild. She's here to stay.
Well, I can imagine Alice feels completely neutrally towards them. So I guess in that way, it's not mutual. You've described AI as a path to sustainability for you. You've said that it is a potential financing source as you also train other media organizations, as your spending and your financing in AI, you both see that increasing in the future. What is your current business model now as it stands?
I think most of the bulk of our money currently comes from grants and foundations, you know, philanthropic foundations and organizations that give grants. That's the bulk of our money. That's where it comes from. We're also trying to set up, you know, business, you know, taking adverts and sponsorship. Yeah, but the issue of adverts and advertising comes with its own challenges on who pays the piper, calls the tune.
And how do you balance, because this seems to be an issue of editorial independence. I guess that's what you're getting at, right? Like this idea if they give you money, then you have to say what they want you to say. How do you get around that? Because obviously you don't want to say what they say.
Honestly, we haven't found a way of getting around that. We are never getting it. I think we're in the thick of it. We might get lost in it. So it's a taste basis. You know, there are things that we're not going to do because we're a community media organization. We're not going to advertise gambling, you know, because we don't want to encourage gambling. I think we're not going to take money from cigarettes, you know, and all. Those are things that we're clear of because of our principles, you know. But there are certain things that there are organizations that do good work, but they can be so influential. And then once someone has paid you a dollar, you know, they would expect you to behave in a certain way. And that's one thing that we're struggling with. We need the money, but we also need the independence. And with media, when you're not financially is sustainable. There's no way you can be independent. And how you become financially sustainable, it's a story that we still don't understand and we are trying to understand. So it's really, a fight between, unfortunately, with donor funding and grants, and there are so many things that are happening globally that are affecting that type of funding. You know, global politics is affecting even us, the local organizations, and we are feeling the pinch on what's happening at the globe, and the money is reducing. So we need to find other alternatives of sustaining ourselves. So we are thinking of other models like membership, in the community, movements supporting us. I mean, communities supporting the work that we do. And we really haven't figured out how the next 5 years will look like in terms of funding.
It really does seem like you're saying that there is a, whether it's grants, whether it's corporate sponsorship, they're both going to have challenges. As you say, the grants, of course, are influenced by whatever else is happening in the world and what editorial priorities a certain foundation would set. And with corporate sponsorship, the money could buy influence, as you say. If you say that you're looking into models like membership and subscription, how much support would you say there is in your community for paid journalism models like that?
Currently, it's very low. People don't want to pay for news because they can find it for free, on WhatsApp. The work that we do every day, someone will go on our website and distribute for free on WhatsApp. So we really need to sell it. People need to buy in the idea and find that by supporting us, the work that site does, they're actually supporting themselves and the community that they do. So we have tried different models of people, subscribing to membership, offering this and that, and it has been slow. So I think people really frown upon paid walls or firewalls or paying for news. But we need to find people who can say, okay, I can give you $5 every month, or I can give you $10 every month. And if we can get 100,000 people who give us $10 every month or $5 every month, then we will survive. So we're really going back to the old, during the war, our comrades used to say, we are the fish, you are the water. And without the water, we cannot survive. And we find ourselves being the fish. And we need the community as the water so that we can survive. So this is why in some of our work, we say, not a day without the news and not an hour without the people. Because without the people, we don't have the audience, we don't have our backbone, and we are all exposed, we suffocate.
You've spoken quite candidly now. We've been talking for quite a while now, and you've spoken quite candidly about the challenges of financing. You've talked about the challenges of introducing new tech. You've talked about the challenges of operating in this very specific environment that you find yourself in. Given all of these challenges, and I know it's a big question, but what does it mean to be viable?
I think being viable means that you can, in simple terms, be able to pay your workers every month. But also, you're not only viable in terms of money, you're also viable in terms of ideas. You might, I think for me, at the end of the day, we viability also means being able to reach the audiences that we want, the numbers that we want, because you can have all the money in this world, but if you don't have the audiences that consume your news, then you are nothing. So we need to be able to be viable financially, and we also need to be viable in terms of the ideas and the content that we produce. We know every day that when we wake up, there's someone who's looking forward to what site is giving them today. They're looking forward to our content, and they're calling us and say, guys, there's a story. By the way, our audience is amazing, because most of the stories that we do, we get them from the audiences. They always tell us this is what is happening. And it's a mixture, doctors, nurses, police, and so forth. And they all provide the sources that we need. And for me, that's halfway to viability.
How much do you know about your audiences?
We try and understand the audience that we do. We do a lot of research. I can say off my head, the bulk of our audience is people between the ages of 18 and 50, the majority being the 24 to 35. Those are the people who are our audience. It's mainly males. We're still trying to raise our numbers with females, but I think 60% of our audience is males and 40% is females. And these are mainly a mixture of people in urban areas and rural areas. But there are people who are really political animals. They love politics more than anything else. So our most read stories are politics. It's community issues. It's service delivery. Those are the things that people, and of course, community stories, you know, the heroes of the communities.
Do you know how many people you reach?
On Facebook, we reach about over a million people a week. We have about 2.6 and 5 million Twitter impressions every week, depending on the stories that we do. Those are the main platforms that we mainly use. We also have a website. We also have a newsletter that we do on a daily basis that we distribute to about 15,000 people on email as well as on WhatsApp groups. Then TikTok and Instagram are new platforms that we have started using, and we are still growing that audience.
We've talked quite a lot about what you're currently doing, what you find your everyday mission to be, serving the community. Where do you plan to take site? What is your mission for your organization? I mean, what is your vision, rather? I already asked about your mission.
Well, we plan to be the premium center when it comes to content, you know, exploring using digital technologies to be able to tell the story of an ordinary person. So we want to be the, you know, we emphasize a lot that we are a platform that produces content. You know, so we want to remain like that our content can be found in whatever new gadget is going to be produced in the next 10 years. So our vision is to be the media house that tells the story of the people of Matabeleland, you know, empower our citizens in terms of information.
And how do you know when that has happened?
When the time comes, we will see the signs. Our people are going to. It's easy when you are talking to people and they know what you are talking about, because they are going to demand answers as much as we do. You know, we come from a Christian background, so there is a popular verse that people talk about that when Jesus exorcised the demons, and then the demons said, "I'm not one; we are many." So the moment the community says it's not only sight, we are many sites, then we will know that we have arrived. The day someone tries to close down sight and the people stand up and demonstrate that you cannot do that, then we'll know that we are with the people. The day the people are going to demand, you know, equality, they're going to demand justice, the day the people will say, yes, of course, we voted for you, but this is not what we want, then we will know that we are with the people and the people are with us.
And as you've been saying throughout this conversation, the people is the most important element of your reporting. Now, our time with you is almost coming to a close, but before we let you go, we really want to hear your three best practice tips for running a media outlet and surviving and thriving.
I think the first one is to don't shy away from experimenting. You know, try new things. You know, failure is not the end of it all. I also think that love what you do. You know, with passion, with love, you will never, you know, feel tired or exhausted.
I'm counting two, Zenzele. So don't shy away from experimentation and love what you do. Do you have a third?
And of course, I mean, at the center of it all is innovation. Keep innovating. The day you stop, you know, innovating, then you are in trouble. And the only way you can predict the future is to create it.
Don't shy away from experimentation. Love what you do. Do not stop innovating. Create the future. I suppose those are some of the best fighting words we will ever hear today. So we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much to our guest today, Zenzele Ndebele of SITE from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe. Thank you, dear listeners. I appreciate you joining us today. Do check out the show notes for more. Till next time on Survive and Thrive.
Thanks for listening to Survive and Thrive, the Media Viability Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and make sure to hit like so that other listeners can find us as well. For feedback, send an email to dw-academy.surviveandthrive@dw.com. You can find all the information in the show notes.